Okay, you recording?
I'm running.
You're good?
I see the signal and everything.
You see the little dots? All right, awesome. Okay. Well then, Randy, how do we start?
You usually go, hey, how you doing, Randy? Something like that.
Hey, Randy, what's going on? Hey, Randy, what's going on?
How's it going, Jim? We're going to have some fun tonight.
Are we? What's going on?
Well, this episode, we're going to talk about the parameterized post-Newtonian formalism. Doesn't that sound like a picnic?
I mean, that sounds like the exact sort of thing everybody wants to hear about.
It's actually pretty awesome.
Do you think you can give me a high-level outline about what the parameterized post-Newtonian formalism is?
Yes, basically, it's general relativity for dummies, and that's a good thing, because compared to Einstein, most of us are dummies. And it's got two features which are absolutely fantastic. Now, it is sort of a stripped-down version of calculations that you would do for general relativity. So it just gives you the first order numbers without doing the full nonlinear calculations. But it's a pretty good approximation. It works with all of this stuff, all the relativistic phenomena in like the solar system, for example. And the great thing about it is that you can kind of engineer with it. You can get actual answers out of it without, you know, spending years slaving over partial differential equations. So not only is it a great calculational tool for people that want to get like approximate answers to questions in general relativity, but it's also this fantastic standardized form that allows you to compare any metric theory of gravity simply by modifying any of the 10 different parameters in the equations.
You said something about it being sort of a first order effect. It's first order in what sense? Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's the Einstein field equations are nonlinear, so that you've got basically a superposition of like gravitational effects upon one another. So the energy density of the gravitational field creates a secondary gravitational field, which is weaker, and that creates a third gravitational field. So it's this like diminishing returns. But it goes on and on. So getting clear answers out of it is really difficult. What this does is it just approximates the numbers that you'd get basically using an asymptotic form so that you're not following the complete curvature of the theory, but you're following enough of it that in the weak field limit, Earth-like gravity, solar kind of gravity, until you get up to the really intense gravitational fields and really high velocities, you've got a nice linear approximation.
So what this is modifying is the curvature.
Yeah, the curvature and this are close enough in the weak field limit that they're very useful and virtually identical to the answers that you'd get by using the complete theory of general relativity. It's a good approximation for cases where you don't have relativistic speeds and super high gravity fields.
The thing I was wondering about is, I guess, maybe not what is the first approximation, but what's the zeroth approximation? So what would the metric tensor be in the zeroth approximation?
Oh, you're thinking of the Newtonian metric, huh?
Well, actually, it's the Minkowski metric, right?
Yeah, I've heard it called both. But yeah, the Minkowski metric.
So basically, the zeroth order approximation is special relativity. And then this first order approximation, you generally call it sort of the linear approximation, the first perturbation of general relativity on special relativity. First nascent effects of gravity on the curvature of space-time.
And since it's based on the metric formulation of general relativity, I gather from this examination in this paper, and we're looking at the paper called The Confrontation Between General Relativity and Experiment by Clifford M. Will from 2014.
This is a wonderful paper. It is, in a sense, a update to Clifford Will's Theory and Experiment in Gravitational Physics, which was a book from the 1980s, 1990s that he did that basically talked about how to use something like the parameterized post-Newtonian framework to look at different ways to compare and test general relativity.
Let me make a note of that. What was the name of that book again?
Theory and Experiment in Gravitational Physics. This is, again, the book that I wanted to do after Quantum Paradoxes.
Sounds good.
So we really get a lot of what's in that book in this paper, but not quite as much of the mathematics. You get a lot of what I think is the really interesting stuff. And in these two sections, the sections 3 and 4 that we're talking about today, I think you get what is very, very useful about this parameterized post-Newtonian framework and the results of it, which is why I expanded this to section 4 as well. So you were talking first about how you can use this framework to compare different types of gravitational theories.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of amazing to me, is that for, I guess, strictly mathematical reasons, NordVet was able to create this formulation that reduced all of these incredibly divergent models and alternative models of gravity into one formalism that allows you to compare them side by side without, you know, any complications.
Yeah. Now these are only certain kinds of gravitational theories, right?
Metric theories, right?
Yeah, these are these metric theories. These are theories that necessarily obey the Einstein equivalence principle. So we talked about equivalence principles a few weeks ago. These metric theories are only those theories that do something in that Einstein equivalence principle regime, where there should be, and this is going to be kind of strange the way we're going to talk about it, that if the Einstein equivalence principle is valid, space-time can be described by a metric like it is in general relativity, by this tensor field that we usually call G. It also has to be symmetric. You have, in the limit, local Lorentz frames. That is, if you look at a small enough region of space-time, it's always going to look like special relativity, and you don't have to worry too much about the gravitational curvature. It's just as you expand, you have to worry about that gravitational curvature. So as you move around, what those axes are doing will change, but still at that local level, axes are going to be Minkowskian.
Mm-hmm. Perpendicular, right.
If you look a little bit off, if you have something that's too large, then that doesn't work as well. Too large compared to the mass. I guess the last thing is, for these metric theories, a test body, a very, very small object, is going to move along a geodesic, just like you think of in general relativity. You know, you're going to move along a line of least action.
Yeah, you're in free fall no matter where you are.
So that's sort of what a metric theory is, and it only works for either a theory that satisfies the Einstein equivalence principle, which is stronger than the weak equivalence principle. So you can't use some of the more famous older alternative gravities. They don't fit into this. So Milne had kinematic relativity in the past. Whitehead, Alfred North Whitehead, the famous mathematician, he had his own version of gravitational theory that, at least when I was in school, somebody told me that it was equivalent, that nobody could test it. But that was in a philosophy class. That was in a philosophical cosmology class. So the philosopher guy hadn't been keeping up. Actually, they'd shown, according to, I think, Will, maybe somebody else, yeah, it had already been disproven 10 years, 20 years earlier.
Right, because at this point, isn't it basically established that the only theories of gravity that can work are metric theories? Or metric theories with maybe a little twist here and there, a little scalar field, a little vector thing here.
These other theories that we're going to talk about are all metric theories. They all have a metric.
That's right. But we know that a successful gravitational theory would have to be a metric theory.
I think it was the experiments and the comparison to experiments that Nordtvedt and Will and people like that were doing in the 70s that proved that, or at least made that really suggestive. I think if you look at some of the data here, it's even stronger. Will isn't really willing to come out and say, because he's a professional, that only general relativity works. But if you look at the numbers that he's got here for all of these parameters, when we look at these parameters, there's not a lot of room.
That's right. General relativity and all of these different crazy experiments is coming out to accuracy within, you know, one part in 10,000, that kind of scale, right? So we know that to high precision that it's pretty right.
And for some of these parameters, it was one part in like 10 to the 20th. For others, it's not that good. But, you know, I mean, it's still...
still pretty darn good. Still no chinks in the armor.
That's very interesting. That's a little bit scary as well. And we'll talk about why that's scary when we get to it, if we get to it. Yeah, I mean, it looks like the nice, simple, nonlinear theory works as well as it can.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that it may sound intimidating when you're looking at a theory with 10 different parameters. But the amazing thing is that general relativity only has non-zero values for two of them, and those non-zero values are one. So that really fairly complex parameterized post-Newtonian theory is reduced significantly when you look at general relativity.
Yeah, and those two parameters, those are things you would expect to be one. The first of those parameters, which is gamma, tests how mass creates the curvature of space-time. And so if that number deviates from one, you get more curvature than you expect or less curvature than you expect from a unit of mass.
So we wouldn't have an inverse square law if it wasn't one, right?
I believe so. Do you remember what kind of experiments tested that?
What kind of experiments tested gamma? Oh, boy. There's a bunch of them. We'll get into them because that's in the second section that we're going to cover.
Okay, so gamma is something you expect. You'd like that to be something like one, and you'd like it to be a constant number. And I think for most of the things where it's not one, it's not a constant number. that's a little bit scary. So you're not really sure exactly what's going on with that. The other one, beta, that's one, is sort of the superposition nonlinearity, which basically means, can you just add results together to get another result, right? If you know that there's something big over here and something big over there and you want to look somewhere in the middle, can you just add the results from the two big things? Every time I've read this, because I've read this both in that other book and in this paper twice now, I was a little annoyed with myself because I'd always thought that because general relativity is a highly nonlinear theory, that superposition basically would not work. But it happens to be balanced out just right so that it is, so that it does. It does work. So beta is one. And that's really wonderful. It might not be necessary, but it makes your life easier.
Yeah, because it makes calculations simpler.
Although there are fewer sorts of problems with that being not one in these other theories.
Yeah, most of the other theories, they have preferred frame effects and violations of global conservation laws for total momentum, things like that, which you wouldn't expect to be physical.
How many different classes, three different classes outside of general relativity that he talks about in this paper, is that right?
Let's see, I'm not sure what you're referring to. I know that he talked about non-dynamic theories and dynamic theories. I'm not sure what other classes he's referring to.
The dynamic and non-dynamic, I think, are interesting cases. And the dynamic is the most interesting one. The non-dynamic is where you say there's something out there that doesn't react to anything else.
Like an absolute space on top of which the theory would have to operate, right?
That's right. An absolute space, a cosmic time, something like that. And there are also other theories where they have some sort of other field. Or they have this additional field that they postulate that functions in such a way that it doesn't really react to anything. They call it prior geometric. It's a priori field that's just part of the theory. It's supposed to be there, like saying that there's a background space-time of some kind or some other background field of some kind that just sits there and does whatever it's going to do. It's just like a big constant. Turns out that that's not really of any interest any longer. That was of much more interest in his book, but he sort of sweeps those under the rug now. So those are no longer really very interesting. It's just those dynamical theories that are interesting. What did you understand about the dynamical theories?
I think that the idea of the dynamical theory is that the curvature of space-time completely determines the motion of the body within it, right? So it's sort of the curved space-time is really where all the action is.
So yeah, the curvature of space-time is the only thing that affects mass. So any object that's being gravitated towards any other object has to follow the curvature of the space-time. There's nothing else out there. But it's how the mass affects the curvature that differentiates the different theories.
And I think with a dynamical theory, all of the different fields, including non-gravitational fields, all couple to the metric. And the structure and evolution of the metric is completely defined by coupled partial differential equations.
I think the important thing is you can have these additional fields, but there's this order. The curvature affects where the masses go. Then the mass, since it's dynamical, all of these other fields have to somehow react to that change of the mass. Now, that could be the curvature itself. Curvature itself changes with the mass, but it could also be any of these scalar or vector or tensor fields that are not the curvature reacting to the mass. And then those other fields can additionally affect the curvature. And that's why all those other things change that mass-curvature coupling, is because there are additional layers between the mass and the curvature of space-time that are doing something to what happens to the mass. Does that make any sense? So the mass only cares about what happens to gravity, or what happens to the metric. But the metric cares about all of these other things. It cares about both the mass and all of these other fields. We don't really know what those fields are, how they work, or anything like that. But all of these other fields that are affected by the mass and affect the curvature as well.
Yeah, that's what I kind of love about general relativity is the stress energy tensor captures all of the information about what's going on. It captures the rest mass, it captures the kinetic energy, it captures the stress, the pressure. And it doesn't matter what form of field is generating those effects, just the quantities matter, and they all add up to give you the curvature.
One of the interesting things is that the way you become this strong equivalence principle is you have this gamma equal 1 and this beta equal 1, and you don't have any of these other parameters being anything but 0. So right now we have exactly one theory that satisfies that strong equivalence principle. That's general relativity. And I like this strong equivalence principle. I mean, it's just like the weak equivalence principle, but it also says something about how self-interactions are viewed.
Self-gravitating bodies fall at the same rate as, test bodies, right?
their own gravity doesn't modify the curvature for them.
Yeah, that's a little hard to get your head around, because you'd think that the presence of two gravitational fields would be additive, but apparently not.
So what do you know about those other parameters? So if we talk about these other parameters a little bit, then I think we're ready to talk about the different theories a little bit. I don't want to talk too much about them, but you know, he's given in this paper a small number of them, but they're all interesting in some way, so we should talk about them. But I think it would be best if we had some idea about these other parameters. There's a C, the Greek letter C. You know, there's a Greek letter that sounds like C.
Is that what that like thing that looks like an E is called?
Yeah, that swirly little E thing.
Okay. I didn't know that was called C.
And that's basically a local position invariance parameter. So if C is anything but zero, that means that gravity can be different in different places. Those alphas are local Lorentz invariance parameters.
Okay, and that's what they call preferred frame effects, right?
And then we have these zetas, and the zetas have to do with Newton's third law and conservation of momentum. So I think the alphas have to do with conservation of angular momentum. So if you do not have local Lorentz invariance, if you have a preferred frame effect, then angular momentum is not conserved in all interactions. With these zetas, you have different ways of having momentum not be conserved, and that means you won't, in the limit, necessarily have Newton's third law come out.
That sounds like a pretty egregious deal.
It's sinful. It's very sinful, Randy.
Momentum is always conserved. Rockets wouldn't work without it, damn it.
And some of these things are fairly interesting. One other way to think about Newton's third law that's especially important in this context is that if any of these zetas is non-zero, the active gravitational mass and the passive gravitational mass are different things. The amount of gravity you make and how much you feel gravity are two different things.
Well, that could be really handy, though.
Could be handy, yeah. I mean, if you can figure out how to violate these zeta things, you've got some engineering ahead of you. And I think that's especially true of the zeta 3. Zeta 3 is the most important one of those things. It seems to have something to do with the electrostatic binding energy of the atomic nucleus.
Hot damn. Which one of these variations on gravity theories has a non-zero zeta 3?
None of them. He excluded all of them.
Okay.
Those would all have some preferred location effect. So he's excluded those. He's excluded anything with a non-zero C and with non-zero zetas and even with a non-zero alpha 3.
And there's probably good reasons for that, because those theories have failed like fundamental tests, right?
So he's stuck to the things that are still actively looked at. And here's where we get to the three categories that I was asking you about earlier.
Which section is that in?
It's right after he talks about FR theories. There's a big table.
Oh, right. Okay. I didn't copy the table. Okay.
It's basically the sort of stuff we were talking about. So I talked about these intermediate fields. There could be these intermediate fields between the mass and the curvature. These are categorized by those fields. So you could have a scalar tensor theory of gravity. Those are the ones that are the most commonly thought of to be viable at this point.
Yeah, that's where the Brons-Dicky theory, that's the leader in there. Okay.
Yeah, that's Brons-Dicky and the FR theory in general. That just has an additional scalar field between the mass and the metric.
And that one's kind of interesting, because we just discovered that the Higgs field is a scalar field. It's universal. So we know that a scalar field can be physical.
And on top of that, the cosmological constant is a scalar field. And we talked about previously, you can look at that either as one of these scalar fields like in a Brons-Dicky formulation, or you can look at it as just an additional thing. But you don't really know what kind of thing that is. And on top of that, dark energy can be modeled in either way, and they seem to be pretty equivalent, at least at this point. You could also have a vector tensor theory. Those are usually less interesting, but they've got some reasons to look at them. That just means that there's a vector field in between the mass and the metric. One thing he's not talking about much here is you could have a bimetric theory. There are a couple of bimetric theories that have been out there, Visser theory and Rosen theory, and those have two tensor fields. And the one last thing that he talks about is a tensor vector scalar field. That's interesting, because in his book, he sort of pushed this aside, but people have been looking at these tensor vector scalar fields recently for a reason.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot in the literature about these. They abbreviate it to TEVES. Do they call them Tevis theories, or do they spell it out?
Nobody talks to me about these things, so I can't tell you. They'd probably call it Tevis.
these are popular because they can sort of replicate the effects of modified Newtonian dynamics, but in a relativistic framework, right?
They try to use these instead of WIMPs for dark matter. You know, we're talking about trying to use gravitational theory to get rid of dark energy because you can't see the dark energy and nobody likes that. Same thing for the dark matter. This week, I saw an article talking about a couple of different groups reporting null results on dark matter again, so that, you know, they've been trying to directly find some WIMPs or something like that. And again, they can't find it. So if you're having trouble finding something, you might try to modify the gravitational theory to put it in there.
But maybe you shouldn't go around looking for WIMPs in the first place. Maybe this is a purely theoretical failure.
Well, the problem is we need some reason for things to act the way they're doing. The problem is that dark matter is not being very nice to us. So we're not getting good results with the WIMPs. I'm not sure how bad these results are. It didn't sound catastrophic to me when I was reading about it, but it doesn't sound good, these experimental results.
Well, they keep ruling out entire classes of options, right?
That's right. But you do that with this tensor vector scalar stuff as well, right? You know, these require that angular momentum is not conserved. That's already bad. But then it also requires these alpha 1 and alpha 2 parameters to be some number. And one of the things we see very, very soon is those numbers have to be pretty small. I think that alpha 2 in particular is highly constrained. No, it's the alpha 3 that's extremely constrained. But alpha 2 is only at 2 parts in 10 to the 9, you know, 2 parts in a billion. So it's in the moderate level.
It hasn't been ruled out to the 10 to the minus 20th level yet, huh?
That's only alpha 3 that's been ruled to the 10 to the minus 20th.
Jesus. But they've all been ruled out to, like, you know, one part in at least a few thousand. You know, it's kind of grasping at straws, it seems like, because they're all kind of failing. Boy, what a conundrum, huh?
You know, it looks cool that you can model something like that with that Tevis. Just, it doesn't seem to work. And the alternative theory doesn't seem to work, at least right now. So I guess it's time to get creative.
You know, is it possible that we're misapplying, misinterpreting something about the mathematics of general relativity? Maybe we're missing something fundamental in the way we apply the theory. Because it just keeps holding up, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's got to be wrong because we can never show that it's
wrong.
I really think that probably general relativity is just right. You know, the other parts of this paper are looking at the stronger limits, and general relativity keeps being fine in those limits. It's all the other alternatives that seem to have problems. In a lot of ways, you might think that it's maybe just our models of galaxies that aren't quite as good as we think, not the basic physics. I'm not sure, but I have a feeling that those things really do have more leeway than 10 to the minus 20.
Yeah, but you'd still need an awful lot of, like, cold, dark asteroids and dead planets and things like that flying around the galaxy in order to account for 10 times the mass that we're seeing, right? That's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's almost to the point of unbelievable, right?
Right.
You know, of the options that I'm given, I don't like any of them.
Yeah, me either.
But that's a good place to be if you're a scientist.
What, so you can tear your hair out staring at the ceiling at night wondering what the hell's wrong with your theories?
It means that if you can come up with a good idea.
Oh, that's right. You get the prize.
Well, you might not get the prize, but at least if it's good enough, you can be taken seriously.
Yeah, but you know that whoever comes up with it, the working, like, a correct intuitive explanation for dark energy and dark matter, or either one of those or both, boy, that's going to be, you're going to Switzerland, man.
Why would you want to go to Switzerland? Wouldn't you prefer to go to Sweden?
Oh, sorry. Oh, I see it here that they found that tight bound on alpha 3 by watching the anomalous eccentricities in the orbits of a number of binary millisecond pulsars.
Yeah, that's fairly interesting. Although at some point he was talking about some of the limits of those binary pulsars. Those supposedly aren't really clean tests of PPN framework, the parameterized post-Newtonian framework, because you've got these really heavy things running around. So they're really SEP things. They're really strong equivalence principle tests at some level because they've got a lot of extra gravitational stuff moving around. Those aren't really clean tests, even though they do use them for bounds with this PPN formalism.
At one point, he goes over the perihelion shift of Mercury. Yeah, that's a really tiny shift. It kind of freaking amazes me that we were able to detect that so quickly. I think everybody's heard the number. It's 43 arc seconds per century of perihelion shift. That's 1/83rd of a degree per century. That's really small.
This perihelion shift to Mercury, that is small, and we were worried when we were missing half of it.
Oh, here's the other thing that I wanted to point out, was that in this beginning of section 4 of this paper, he gives a really nice diagrammatic representation of the deflection of starlight around the sun, and it seemed like it intuitively showed you how the reason that the deflection is twice what the Newtonian prediction would be, is that half of that deflection is due to the curvature of space-time. It's almost like an additive thing. Like, you've got the classical attraction to the sun, plus you've got the curvature of space-time distorting the metric by an equal amount.
Yeah, if the mass-curvature coupling is 1-to-1. And in both of those theories, the Brons-Dickey and the FR theory, that number is less than 1.
I guess we need a much more precise measure of that deflection to see if we could find a deviation from 1.
Did you look at the next figure, figure 5, which is a little bit odd because it's sort of a historical figure showing the year of the experiment and the bounds on the deflection of light. The amount is tiny. Oh, it's only 2 parts in 10,000 for the best light deflection measurement, and 2 parts in 10^-5, or 2 parts in 100,000 for time delay measurements. You know, the numbers, again, are tiny. The amount that's less than 1 is tiny, which means that the coupling parameter has to be huge. That omega for the Brons-Dickey formulation has to be huge to be viable.
But didn't they rule out huge values of omega?
No, they've been ruling out small values. Omega has to be greater than 40,000, or at least that's what they said in one of those previous papers that we read. The larger that number, the less coupling, basically. Or the larger that number, the less that scalar field interferes with the mass creating the curvature.
Yeah, I'm not sure I followed that, but
when the mass modifies that scalar field, the effect is that the mass does less.
Oh, it gets screened by the scalar field, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The scalar field is screening the effect of the mass on the curvature of space-time.
I was looking around online earlier tonight, and I swear that I saw a list of all these different alternative theories of gravity, and that all of these theories that we are looking at in this paper have been pretty much pushed so far into the realm of unlikelihood that they're pretty much hopeless, more or less.
That's absolutely true. There's only one issue with that.
What's that?
The other ones are worse. All of the ones that he's not putting in here have even worse problems. But we are talking about things that are actively being researched, at least. So that Tevis and the FR theories, people are using them for particular reasons, which are dark matter for Tevis and dark energy for the FR theories. They're being used for real, meaningful stuff. We should take them seriously.
And you know what? Just to be fair, I think that we should also throw in the inflationary epoch of the early universe. I mean, it's not a current conundrum, but it's just as valid a problem, right?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a problem for some of these theories. And it's definitely a problem with some of the measurements that we talk about, right? One of the issues with some of these different things that we're testing is that they end up giving you a changing gravitational constant.
Right, over time.
And if that's not happening, that is bad for those inflation models. Alpha 1 seems to be related to that.
Yeah, but then they said that their model of like baryogenesis or something way back in the very early cosmos, that measurements on there showed that the gravitational constant had to be within 20% of the current value. So if it changed, it hasn't changed much, and that adds a problem, right?
Yeah, so that is a problem. First, you have that they've got two different ways. That was baryogenesis and what helioseismology. Both of those said that there's not a lot going on. On top of that, they've got other ways of looking at the orbit of Mars, right? The ephemeris of Mars. There's so many things that are interesting in astronomy that are screened by astrology on the internet. And this was one of them, because he talked about the ephemeris of Mars. I had no idea what the hell that was. And all it is really a prediction of what its trajectory is going to be. But, you know, they've been doing this for a very, very long time, probably because of the astrology. So they've been able to use that to show that G is changing less than 17% per gigaannum. That's basically the worst case scenario of the best measurement. G changes 17% every billion years. If you look at the average value of the best measurement, which is better than his estimates from helioseismology and baryogenesis, well, 17% is better than those two things. If you look at the average value, if you look at the best value for that, it's 0.1, or it's 1% per gigaannum.
Oh, geez, yeah.
1% per billion years. I mean, it really doesn't look very good. Now, there are 13 billion years to play around with.
Yeah, but you'd need a really dramatically different G in order to explain inflation. You'd need to invert it.
Something really strange has to happen at some point. And, I mean, they just don't see any real reason to believe that that's actually happened.
Yeah, I'm surprised that there isn't more of an outcry about that, because I was looking at inflation last night, but there was the pressures and temperatures and energy density. You'd think that the universe would have collapsed into a black hole almost instantly instead of expanding it. And I did a quick calculation, and it looks to me like the rate of expansion during inflation had to be about 10,000 billion billion times the speed of light.
Yeah, it is huge. And if you just look at the pictures, it's pretty obvious, right? If you look at the graphs that they show, it's just moving along. And then all of a sudden, there's this giant, huge expansion, and then just a sort of gradual one after that. And yeah, I mean, for no particular reason, it just happened. It's not going to work if this doesn't happen right there. So it's got to have happened right there.
Yeah, and it happened within a period of like 10 to the minus 33 seconds. I also realized that the energy levels at that point during inflation, basically the energy density, was like 20 orders of magnitude higher than the energy densities that we're getting now in our best accelerators creating quark gluon plasma. That's a lot, 10 to the 20 orders of magnitude denser. Can't even dream of exploring that level of physics yet.
No. I mean, all sorts of weird things happen, right?
But yeah, but maybe that's a good thing, because I was thinking, you know, if we get to that level, are we going to like precipitate an instantaneous moment of ridiculous inflation?
We don't know how our universe started. It may have been somebody with a particle accelerator. You know, they're not going to get to those energy densities. We don't have the kind of energy flux into our system so that we could make something like that.
I think I heard Michio Kaku one time saying that in order to probe energy densities of that level, we'd have to have a circular accelerator like the diameter of the orbit of Saturn or something like that.
That's not too much of a problem then, right?
Yeah, we could do that next week.
Well, I mean, we've got an asteroid belt, so we've got all the materials just sitting there ready for us.
Yeah, all we need to do is just organize it at a solar scale.
How much trouble could that really be? Okay, so we've gone through three of these tests for alpha 1 and beta. So what else do we have? We have alpha 2 and alpha 3. I guess we talked about alpha 3, which was sort of the pulsar acceleration, right? The orbital eccentricities of binary millisecond pulsars. Then alpha 2 was actually very interesting, alpha 2 and C, which has to do with the spin precession. The interesting thing about that is it's got to do with the anisotropy of the gravitational constant. So alpha 2 has something to do with the anisotropy of the gravitational constant. And so they were trying to measure that with gravitometers on the Earth. And I guess apparently until very recently, that was the best measurement for that. So people were just walking around measuring gravity on the Earth and trying to see if it was more this way than that way.
It seems like it could be a little tricky given the inhomogeneous nature of the Earth's core and everything.
They have ways to try to look at stuff like that. I should have looked more at what this actually means, but we're looking at the limiting effect of the anomalous torque on an object. So some additional torque from those inhomogeneities. But now the bounding torques on those millisecond pulsars are better, although they're strong equivalence principle things because the binary pulsars have two heavy things orbiting each other. So now we've talked about how they test all these things, and looks like general relativity is the only game in town if you look at these things. So this is why, you know, in the last couple of episodes we've talked about gravity, you know, I've kind of been a little bit leery about all these other things. It's because, you know, I keep reading these numbers. You know, I was reading the numbers from 1994 and it didn't look good, and everything got much, much more constrained since then. So they've done a lot of good work on this. But I was wondering what you thought about the Nordvet effect.
That's where the accelerations between bodies change with the self-gravitational energy.
Yeah, they have different rates based on their gravitational self-interactions in scalar tensor theories.
That's a violation of the weak equivalence principle.
It's a violation of the strong equivalence principle. That's the difference between EEP and SEP, is that the gravitational self-interactions change things.
Okay. Well, we haven't detected any violations of either.
This is also interesting because it creates a polarization of the Earth-Moon system directed at the sun.
Oh, right. That was interesting. But we don't detect that, and it was like it should be readily detectable, right?
I'm not sure. The way they test this is through the lunar laser ranging.
Yeah, which are really precise.
So that's another thing that I think might be interesting to talk about, just like gravity probe B might be interesting to talk about at some point after we figure out what exactly they do. or in order to figure out exactly what they do. Because, I mean, they get a lot of information out of this lunar ranging experiment.
But it's a simple experiment. I mean, you've got to filter. I guess the tricky parts are factoring in atmospheric distortion and, you know, all that kind of thing. You know, that must be tricky. Like, you need to get the density of the atmosphere all the way through modeled pretty well, or your time calculations are going to be off. But I guess, you know, we should have a satellite doing laser ranging, because it just seems like you could get way more precise measurements, wouldn't you? I guess it'd be hard to target a satellite to hit the reflectors, though, maybe.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Did you go through, like, the section 4.5 and really figure out exactly what they were going to be doing?
I didn't see anything like that. I did see a whole bunch of upcoming satellite experiments that are going to increase the constraints on all of these parameters. I just kind of glossed over those because there are a lot of them, and a lot of them are probably already launched. And
well, yeah, I'm sure they've all been launched. A lot of them probably have data that's come back. Although, with this being a living review, I would have expected that if any of them said...
Oh, he updates it?
So, yeah, the whole point of having this be a living review is that it should be updated. This is LRR2014-TAC4, so I'm assuming it's been updated 3 times. I'm not sure, but I mean, I expect that's what the TAC4 means. The other option is it's the 4th article. I'd expect that if there was anything especially interesting, he'd add that in. Okay, so I think we've gone through most of the stuff. Did you see anything interesting in his short discussion about gravito-electromagnetism?
Wait, there was a talk on gravito-electromagnetism? That's one of my favorite subjects. I remember reading about some frame-dragging stuff, but I don't know if that was in this paper or if that was other research I was doing.
That should have been in here. So section 4.4 talks a lot about the search for gravito-electromagnetic effects and geodetic precession, which I think is basically more gravito-electromagnetic stuff. But that's okay, because most of that's a discussion about gravity probe B.
I think gravity probe B, in addition to the terrible problems that they had with the little patch charges on the gyroscopes, was that the geodetic effect, which is like a precession effect induced just by the curvature of space-time, is like 3 orders or 4 orders of magnitude greater than the frame-dragging precession. So it's a really tiny signal, and so they only got like confirmation of the predictions of general relativity within 20%. But then he also talks about the Lagos experiment and some other experiments, and somewhere in there they've got a pretty, like, a 0.1% or something like that precision test somewhere in this. Maybe it's an astronomy measurement, but I think we've got frame dragging confirmed pretty high levels of precision too.
It seemed to be what I read is that the lens theorem effect was pretty well confirmed.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that I wanted to mention, is that we were also looking at linearized weak field limit equations for doing GR explicitly with respect to frame dragging effects when we were looking at the Robert Forward papers. I think we were looking at guidelines to anti-gravity and some really cool thought experiments that he had in there. Was that also some kind of post-Newtonian formalism that he was using?
Well, I think what he was doing was he was just doing expansions.
Oh, he was using like a Maxwell model, wasn't he?
He may have been. My general impression was that, maybe not in that paper, but at least in one of the other ones, he was using just a normal sort of expansion. The big selling point for this parameterized post-Newtonian formalism is that that we're able to look at the structure of all of these theories, the structure they had to have to satisfy these things, basically that, you know, they have to have a symmetric metric and stuff like that, and then put these equations together that different constants you could use to tell you what was going on. That's the big difference. Forward was just assuming general relativity was right and looking at things in that small region. But the way he did that would not be able to tell you in any way whether or not general relativity was right or another similar theory was wrong. You could do that, but you have to do it for each and every theory. So what these guys did is they put together a way to
Standardize them all,
but to be able to create a formalism that could get rid of classes of theories, basically, just by comparing experiment to theory. You figure out what the bounds are on these parameters, that's what we've been talking about, and then you can focus down on what theories could be viable. If they can be viable, what levels of parameters would be viable? What would that omega have to be, right? And so forth and so on. So that's the big deal here. It's different from what Forward did. It's significantly different and significantly harder. And if you look at those equations in box two, you'll notice that. I tried to avoid those equations in box two because even for somebody who doesn't mind math, you know, having a 3 or 4 line equation is bad. I've seen worse, but a 3 or 4 line equation is very difficult to understand, even if you were the one who derived it. But again, I've seen worse. I've seen aberration calculations for optics, and they can be extremely nasty.
What did you call it? An aberration?
Aberration.
Oh, aberration, of course. Yeah. Oh, I had no idea it was that complex.
If you go out to more orders, things get uglier. And especially, there was a time when technology kept getting better, but we didn't have computers to do all the numerical calculations. So the way you had to improve things is to do an additional order on your perturbation. And a lot of time went into going into that third or fourth perturbation. In some fields, it still goes on, but in most applied fields, they don't do that much anymore.
Isn't this exactly the kind of situation the complex mathematics of general relativity and other metric theories? Isn't this an ideal situation for a computer program so that you could just get some workable numbers out of different configurations of matter and energy and pressure and stress and everything else? Does that exist?
I'm sure it exists at some level.
I've ever heard about a computer program that just allows you to get results, numerical results, out of general relativity, and it would be so handy to have.
Yeah, I mean, everybody wants one, right?
Yeah, but couldn't that be done? I mean, all of these can be kind of approximated with algebraic formulas.
In the end, if you wanted it to work correctly, it would have to be dynamical, so it wouldn't be algebraic at some level. At some level, you'd have to go to differential equations.
Can computer programs do a differential equation?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there are all sorts of different ways to do numerical calculations. It's just that they take time. Numerical relativity is a thing. Question is, you know, how useful is it to the people who actually do it? Try to make a general model. At what point does it become a little bit too much for not just you, but for the computer, right? So how much work do you have to do to get something in such a state that the computer can do the calculations in a reasonable amount of time?
You know, I'd be happy to have just a first-order approximation like this formalism offers, you know, just something to play with.
I mean, that probably exists at some level. Questions about how user-friendly it is and how difficult it is to get. It probably isn't too difficult to get. There's probably half a dozen on GitHub somewhere. All you have to do is find them and then compile them.
All right, I'm going to do some digging.
Okay. All right, well, I don't have anything more on this. Do you have anything more?
No, we're good. We've covered it all.
All right. Well, then, thank you very much for talking tonight, Randy.
Thank you, Jim.
I hope we have a great time talking about something else in another week or two.
I'm sure we will. We always do.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.